Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon. I want to welcome you to today's show of the American College Experience. It's the first show of the new year, and we're excited that you're listening in today or on the podcast later in the week. I want to thank you for your support of the UR Tennis Network as we continue on our mission here to bring you the interviews that you don't often hear about. And we've been doing this now for about 5 years, and we've had many shows on the air. We currently have a lineup that includes on Tuesday morning at 11:30, we have the Parenting Aces with Lisa Goodman Stone. She broadcasts out of Atlanta, Georgia, and she discusses things related to junior tennis and being a parent in junior tennis. On Wednesday, before my show comes on the air, we have head coach Chuck Creasy of the Citadel, and he broadcasts American Tennis with Chuck Creasy. He usually does that at about 11 o'clock Central Standard Time. Then you have my show, The American College Experience, which is a show geared for the college tennis fan. In this world of mostly professional tennis, we hope to give you some insight into one of America's best-kept secrets. We'll explore all things related to college tennis in the United States. We'll discuss diversity, schedule, facilities, education, and recruiting. We will tackle the tough issues that are facing many of America's college coaches today. And each show gives the listener a different perspective on the college tennis scene. And then Thursday afternoon at 4:30 Central Standard Time, we have John Denise with the Florida High School Tennis Coaches Association perspective. John broadcasts, he's been doing this now for about 6 months, and we're so excited to have him on board the network. We hope that you'll listen in. Remember, if you aren't catching the live broadcast, then you can always catch all of our podcasts over at iTunes. Just look for the UR Tennis Network. That's the, and then the letters UR, the number 10, the letter S, Network. We've got some interesting news that came out of the college tennis scene finally. We've been on break here for a while with the college coaches, the college kids not in school. And we've entered into the spring season, which in my opinion is one of the best things about college tennis. It's the dual match format season. So we're excited that we've entered into that. And they recently released the ITA collegiate rankings for Division I. And there were some interesting additions to the top 10 on the men's side. At number one, we had Virginia. At number two, Oklahoma. Number three, TCU. Number four, Baylor. Number five, Texas A&M. Number six, Illinois. Number seven, Georgia. Number eight, USC. Number nine, North Carolina. And number 10, Ohio State. What's interesting about this is the top five. We've got one, two, three Texas teams. Three of those teams, or two of those teams, are in the Big 12. Three teams in the Big 12 are ranked in the top five. And on the women's side, we have the had the head coach Jeff McDonald on the air, and his Vanderbilt Commodores are ranked number one. At number two is USC. Number three is Florida. Number four, North Carolina. Number five, or tied for fourth with North Carolina, is Georgia. Number six is California. Number seven is Virginia. Number eight is Stanford. number 9 UCLA and number 10 Texas A&M. And being a Texas guy, I was glad to see one of the Texas schools ranked in the top 10 after you see so many Texas teams in the men's top 10. On today's show, we have head coach of the Harvard men's team, David Fish. David's been at Harvard for about 39 years. He's had a winning record since he's been there. His record is 626 wins, 284 losses, and one tie, and that's an interesting result. He has about a 70% winning percentage and has guided his teams to 22 NCAA championship appearances in 39 years. And his team is currently ranked to number 32 in the recent ITA poll. And he's also a big supporter of the UTR Universal Tennis Rating System. And we're going to talk a lot about Harvard tennis today and about the UTR. So let me see if I can bring Coach Fish on the air. Hi, Coach Fish. Are you there?
How are you, Jason?
I'm having a great day. It's a little cold here in Texas. How about where you're at?
Well, we actually have a beautiful day, and around Christmas, I was in my shorts. So, you know, we got to – things are changing here. So we're enjoying a beautiful day up here right now, and I hope you guys don't get beaten down too badly down there.
So not much indoor tennis this time of year, huh?
Well, still indoors, but it's awfully nice to walk outside. So we're fortunate. We can go either way. We get a – get a nice day, we go outside, we get a cold day, we stay inside, we don't miss a beat. So we're pretty lucky.
Well, that's good. Well, we're going to jump into this. We've got a lot to talk about today. And first thing I wanted to talk about was your fall tennis. How did your fall season go this year?
Well, we had fun. We had one of our top players was out with some tendonitis in his knees. So we look forward to having him back in there. Sebastian Beltrame, who's a terrific prospect, 6'5", and has got some ATP points, and just a wonderful guy, but he wasn't able to compete at all this fall. And our number one returning player, Nikki Hu from Northern Cal, had to drop out of our regionals after he pulled a hamstring, but then has been doing great. He just qualified for the futures out at USC in California by beating Colin Altamirano and Michael Genender to get into the main round. I haven't heard yet whether he plays Tom Fawcett, the number one at Stanford. So it's a pretty exciting move for him, and we're always happy as coaches when we see our kind of unheralded players do well and improve. I think that's the great thing about college tennis is I still think guys have huge room to improve, and we give them a chance.
Yeah, now the fall season, an interesting season, and a lot of individual tournaments out there that the coaches enter their players in, USTA events, futures, other events. Coach, what's your philosophy about fall tennis? How do you prepare for the spring and your fall?
Oh, I really love the fall tennis because we can sort of structure exactly the right level of competition for each of our players. So if I've got a number 13 guy that's coming on and he's developing his game, we somehow there's a D3 tournament or a lower level D1 tournament. You just have a chance to get all your kids playing, which is really fun. It's not fun for a coach to see good players sitting on the bench. And so when we gear up for the spring term, knowing that some of the guys won't be able to be competing on a regular basis, we do our absolute best to get everybody in action and see what they do and have it really be a developmental process where they're not worried about rankings. They're not too worried about their position on the team. They're just trying to get better. And as a coach, that's sort of the candy of coaching is seeing players develop, and the competition is fun. And that's kind of like taking a test, but, watching guys improve every day and sort of hit their marks and try to get better at one thing every day. That kind of is the secret of teaching them to do anything well.
You spend a lot of time on individual practices, Coach?
We do. I really don't think that tennis is really an individual sport, Jason. I don't have to tell you that. It's you can create a wonderful systematic way for people to train in a really healthy environment. But the real individual particulars that people need to define their game at a very specific level and to really, really almost distill the best of their game into different plays that they'll repeat over and over again. I think all that's done on the practice court. And so we will set up a number of private meetings with our players to go over that. And then that really makes their practice, when they come to a team practice, then they're really all about implementation. How do I take what I took on that court and go off and really drill it in so that I feel confidence under pressure to do that? You know, on a break point, I see an opportunity rather than just trying to play it safe. And so those are the building blocks, and any good coach will know that. But we get to do it in the fun of a team environment, which I often joke with recruits that they'll have no idea that coming out of junior tennis is like being thrown out of the frying pan into a jacuzzi. It's just so much more fun to live and die and succeed and fail with teammates that you train hard with every day. If you lose, you're always there happy that someone else has won. If you win, you feel bad if your team doesn't win, and you would trade it. I think it creates a wonderful bond in the best sense, and helps particularly young men and women. I think it helps them really develop the tools that they need to be good parents and good employees, to manage people well. I think all those things, that's the reason that companies value people who have succeeded in an individual sport well, because to be successful, they've had to learn a lot of those really tough lessons. It doesn't always, you know, they're bad actors in every sport, but most of the guys are really trying to do their best and really do benefit from that kind of rigorous training. It's training under fire, and they have to learn to handle themselves with poise. And that's what's fun as a coach, particularly having been through it a long time, to see our guys go off and do something special in an industry or in a public service project or as a doctor. I guess that's really what it's all about in the long run. Much as I'll be really competitive with my fellow coaches. We all want to win, but it's all in service of producing a great product that keeps tennis going.
Coach, how much do you change in a player's game in the fall season, or do you just refine? You mentioned putting plays in that these kids can run and practice. How much? What's the difference there?
Well, the difference. Really, Jason, I think by the time kids get to college, a lot of grips and things are sort of fixed. They've been doing it for a long time, and to a certain extent, to play at our level, they've been successful at it. So we find that a number of the improvements that we make often are in the biomechanics of balance, posture, increasing stability of muscle groups so that they're able to do what they already know to do, only at a higher level of execution, a higher level of repeatability. But the real interesting stuff comes is that I often use an analogy if you walk into a diner, the waiter will hand you a menu and there'll be 300 items on there. And the chef, without any offense meant to the chef who can prepare 300 meals, he's a darn good chef, but he's not going to work at the Ritz-Carlton. And if you look at Federer and Nadal and Djokovic and Murray and those guys, they're doing their best plays over and over again, and they're in a tug of war with the other guy to keep him from imposing the other guy's style on them. And so if we say we played a match with 100 points, probably 20 of the points are going to be decided by the other guy's winners, and 20 are going to be decided by my 20 winners. But the other 60 in there are going to be decided by who gets the first drop on the other person and who can execute it. And if I've executed a certain pattern of play that is serving out wide, stepping over to my left, looking for a forehand, hitting that inside out, see what that gets me. If I've done that hundreds and hundreds of times, I'm better than the generalist or the short order cook in the diner who can do everything, but he doesn't do anything at a gourmet level. And so a lot of what we will train is to give kids an idea, a bigger vision of what their game has, and to say, if you distilled this into the best practices of what you're doing, here's what you could do. And here's an example of that player on the pro tour who is able to do that, and watch him repeat these patterns over and over again. I think we very quickly you see that these college players can hit essentially most all the shots that the pros can hit. The pros' perfection is consistency. They can do it over and over and over again. Our guys can't do it as repeatedly. That's often the real difference. Of course, there's extraordinary talent on the pro tour, but we get guys in college that are playing some of the best mental tennis you've ever seen. And some will go on to do well in the pros. Others will be making the absolute best of their physical talents, and they have minds that would be successful pros in the top 10, but their physical skills aren't big enough. So the nice thing about college tennis, you've got them all, and it's kind of a petri dish for experimenting and getting better. And so it's kind of never-ending opportunity in college.
Coach, you're at Harvard, one of the most prestigious schools in the country, and I'm curious, how many students go to Harvard?
About 6,000 undergrad, about 6,000 in the graduate schools. And what most people don't realize, Jason, is that probably one in every six students at Harvard are varsity athletes. Harvard has the largest intercollegiate athletic department in the country. They have 42 varsity sports and are so committed to what the varsity experience can be in the developmental process of a young person that they have seen fit to keep supporting all of these sports. It's remarkable and mind-numbing sometimes, but in some ways it's an undertold story, because we often joke that if you look at the moon up in a beautiful sky without any other lights, it's fantastic. But if you put the moon right next to the sun, it's pretty hard to see the moon at all. And I think that our athletic program at Harvard is like the moon. It is spectacular. If you looked at it just on its own, we've got professional athletes, Olympic athletes, NCAA champions, some of the top players in the world. But next to the academic reputation, it kind of pales in comparison to all these Nobel Prize winners and champions of industry and et cetera. So I have fun, and I'm delighted for the opportunity to talk about, you know, how neat the athletic program is at Harvard. We've got people like Tommy Amaker, who's taken our basketball program to new heights, and Jim Murphy, who's just created a sensational record in football. We've got a hockey team that just has won the NCAA championship and beat Minnesota last week. Just special programs and special coaches. So I've always felt it was a huge privilege to be there and coach with some of the best educators in the country. And this is nothing against other programs. I'm just delighted to tell the story of how much Harvard values athletics.
Right. So what makes the school so attractive to your tennis players?
I think we're a little bit like the Marines, Jason. We're looking for a few good men. And so it's a very fine line. We're looking for the kids who still have a burning desire to see how good they could be, because at Harvard, you always sort of want to figure out how do you try to be the best. We want to compete among the best players in the country, but we don't want to just use our ability to help someone by supporting them in the admissions process. We don't want to use that just as an opportunity to take someone who would be taking that opportunity away from someone else who might go on to change the world. So we're looking for that kind of unusual young man who is kind of understands that his tennis is really still important, but he also has a kind of burn to say, you know, I'm capable of more than that. I'd like to develop myself a lot socially and academically during that time. Is that there's no reason that I can't spend 4 hours a day on the tennis court and still make a really productive time out of the rest of my time and meet people that'll change my life and that I'll bump into wherever I travel in the world. And so I think that package is very appealing to the right people. So we spend a lot of time trying to say, what is that right young man? And it has to be someone who's kind of interesting, and interested in the world that doesn't see that there's only tennis in the world. I mean, we're like any professor at Harvard. We think our course is the most important course given at the university. So Andrew and I want to find players that, you know, tennis just feels like everything. But we also know that tennis is going to have a natural conclusion for all of them. Even a James Blake, who's still involved in tennis, his playing career is, you know, except for playing on the Champions Tour and stuff, that's done. And we love it that the kids carry with them skills that go past their tennis life. You look at Larry Scott, who's now commissioner of the Pac-12, and was the CEO of the Women's Pro Tour and was COO of the Men's Pro Tour. Those are special guys that go on to do wonderful things in the world of tennis if they decide to stay in sports, and or they go into other things and do wonderful things there. So to me, we still joke with them that they'll do some harebrained things when they're on the team because they're still growing up, and then suddenly something clicks and they actually become responsible later. So it's a lot of fun to watch them grow.
Right. I mentioned, Coach, you mentioned that I should mention that you had the fortunate opportunity to coach James Blake there at Harvard. What was he like as a young kid?
Well, it was really interesting. We were just talking about this yesterday with his junior coach, Brian Barker, who was, in my opinion, one of the finest developmental coaches in the country. James was with him from a young age and actually was getting a little burned out when he was younger, just kind of from pressure. And then Brian was wise enough to kind of keep him going, and his brother had come to Harvard, and so James wanted to follow. And so in many ways, we were fortunate to have him. He would have been a champion anywhere, Jason. He just got better and better. And the nice thing at Harvard was everywhere he goes, he's been talked about as a Harvard player for the last 15 years or so. And he was he had I call him the Batmobile. Is that there would be times when he would just be playing and say, "Well, James is, you know, he's probably, this is not going to be his day," and he'd say, "Well, you know, the kid's done great, and now he's finally come up against a tough day. He's not feeling that well," and then all of a sudden something happened, it'd be a bad line call or something. All of a sudden he'd hit the Batmobile and he'd just fire out and just launch past someone. So he had a capacity that was good. I think his coach was saying he grew 7 inches in 1 year and went from a little guy that just kept the ball and play a lot to just a dynamic and dangerous hitter. So he was fun, but he could be a hothead like anybody. I think one of the greatest things about James is that while he still had a temper and he had a strong ego, and I don't think you get to be a great player at that level without a strong ego. He has been in some very sort of interesting and sensitive situations, like what happened at the U.S. Open out in front of the hotel last year. And he's handled them in a very statesmanlike way. I've been really, really proud. I think that's a measure of his family, the kind of values they hold, his coach, Brian Barker. And hopefully we didn't change that pattern. So I think he's been a wonderful asset toward keeping a reasoned conversation about topics that other people are all too happy to inflame with comments and to feel poorly done by. And he just somehow he's sensitive to it. A number of years ago with Leighton Hewitt, there was an incident at the U.S. Open, and some insinuations about an African-American linesman. And James just handled it. You know, he said, "Look, we're all competitors out there." And that's just all it was in the heat of the moment. So by being forgiving, I think he's represented himself and his family well, but he's also represented the values that we try to stand for.
Was it always his intention to go pro, or did he decide that during his career there at Harvard?
I think the glimmerings were starting to come just not too long before he came to college. Brian was actually friends with Mats Wielander, who was living down in Southern Connecticut at that time. And Mats sort of would, every so often, Brian would say, look, James, if you're a good guy in our clinic, instead of, you know, being like the spoiled guy that thinks he's too good to be here, if you're a good example to all the rest of the kids in the clinic, I'll arrange for you to play with Mats as a reward. And so occasionally they would play, and Mats would come over to Brian afterwards and say, you know, Brian, James just might have it. He just might have it. And so there's kind of that glimmering, that feeling. And so the idea was to go to college, see how well he could do, and nobody really imagined that he'd be sort of the best in college by quite as early as he did. But there was that. There was kind of that spark. And so essentially the plan was, if people are offering you so much money and you've shown yourself to be the best in college by that time, but you could come back and pay for your college education easily after that and you have enough guarantees to go, then we would all want you to go. Because it's a little bit like, I joke with people that you know, when it's time for a leaf to fall off a tree, you don't sit there with a staple gun and try to hold it on. And so it was the right time for him. And he still got knocked around a lot on the tour before he made some headway. And I really think that one of his real coming of ages was the very unfortunate death of his father. And but I think it just sort of showed James that, you know, talent is a privilege and you only have so long to take advantage of it. And I think he's made his family proud and done a really good job of it. So we hoped that he would do well, but I don't think anybody ever said that guy is for sure top four in the world.
Yeah. What was special about him in regards to your team? What did he bring to your team?
Oh, he brought a belief that we're going to get this done. He would sit in a team gathering and we might lose a doubles point. He said, well, guys, I'm going to get mine. What about you guys? And I think he brought out the best in other players after they would see James do something remarkable on the court. He had incredible speed and so he would try things and then the other guys would look at it and say, well, if he can do that, why can't I? And he had some very very talented teammates around him. But I think that's where people have an ability to lift players to a higher level. And I think the sad thing was when James was a freshman, his brother Tommy was a senior, and Tommy pulled his hamstring right in the beginning of April when we were getting ready for our Ivy League season and the NCAAs. And we still lost a great match to Georgia in the round of 16s at Athens, but you know, it was just a juggernaut team, and the two brothers had really looked forward to competing hard, and Tommy was not anywhere near his full strength. So, but still, they had a great run and wonderful memories. And his partner Kunj Madmadar was a sensational doubles player, and he made James better, and James made him better, and so it was a fun run, and bunch of good guys.
Coach, you mentioned you're in the Ivy League. What other teams participate in the Ivy League besides Harvard?
It's Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Dartmouth, and then Penn, Cornell, Columbia, and Brown. So it's the most stable, enduring conference in the country, and so it's all schools that try to sort of share like-minded ideas. They don't give scholarships, but they give financial aid based on need, so that it's a marvelously competitive league. And I think last year we were looking at three, almost four of the teams made it into the NCAAs. You know, it's really strong. I kind of call it the sixth super conference. It's just been marvelously competitive. And so people have come and competition is terrific. The depth is terrific. And if you look at how some of the teams are doing now nationally, it's impressive.
through your years, have you developed rivalries within the conference, and who are they?
Oh, I think we have rivalries with everybody. Obviously, the Harvard-Yale tradition is really, in football, that's the game. And so that's always an important match. We have a wonderfully competitive but friendly, respectful rivalry with them. And then I think because we've done well, I think we're sort of always a target, even in our off years. And so we'll have a healthy rivalry with anybody. You know, some years it's Cornell, some years it's Columbia, some years it's Penn, some years it's Brown, some years it's Princeton. It comes and goes. We just try to be among that top group. And it's been a fun run for us because we've made it to the NCAAs for the last 4 years running and done it with great kids that have kept, a 3.0 average and qualified for academic All-American. So that's sort of what our goal is. And we love it when we can win the Ivies, but we love it if we can get to the NCAAs and do some damage there, which we've been able to do. And so it's kind of a great conference.
Yeah. How important are these rivalries to the development of your team?
Well, I think they bring out the best in us. I think that's the magic of college tennis, Jason, is that we all sort of feel this individual pride and, there's sort of our team spirit and our school spirit. And so we put money into building great facilities. We create great alumni support. We try to have great coaches. We try to find great kids. And all over the United States, that's happening, whether it's at a D3 level, which is hugely competitive now, so much more competitive than it used to be, or the highest D1 levels, is that's happening everywhere. And if you create that kind of environment where enough people are able to play in a system where it's a merit-based system, and one of the things when we talk about UTR is the difference between playing in an age-based system where you can have multiple levels of players versus a college-based system, which is level-based. You don't play 22 and under or 24 and under. You play against the best if you're the best. And if you're not the best, you play against other kids your level. And so I think that it creates an environment of improvement that is really second to none. And it's a fantastic experience. So I it's no wonder that people from all over the world want to come and play in the system because they get better, they have great friendships, they get educated at the same time. It's unparalleled in the world. So I think to me it's a very special sauce for American tennis, and if that's why we all work so hard to preserve college tennis, to protect it, because we coaches really control probably a huge percentage of the tennis real estate in the United States, and certainly many of the best facilities anywhere. So it's a very precious resource that we all have a responsibility to keep up. And as you know, we've talked over the years, is that in other countries, their juniors are more naturally connected to playing with their older peers. In college, we're a very self-sufficient group, so we really don't need to be competing against the juniors. But I think American tennis would be much healthier as we start to develop more opportunities for juniors to interact with college-age players and keep our post-college players playing longer the way they do in other countries. And that's the encouraging thing, is that's starting to happen more.
Coach, a lot of coaches approach tennis as a team sport with individual opportunities. You seem to approach it as an individual sport with team opportunities. Where did that philosophy come from?
Well, it's interesting. My mentor, Jack Barnaby, was just a marvelous person and probably the reason that I'm in coaching now. And I one time said, Jack, do you ever get tired of coaching? Because you're kind of coaching the same forehand, same backhand. He said, Dave, don't think that for a second. He said, the beauty of coaching is that every person is different. Every person processes your words differently. And so the challenge is to find a window into that person's mind that just right for the way he or she processes information. And so everybody's different. We have fingerprints that are different. We process We process success and failure differently. And so if I were to treat everybody like a cookie cutter, that you just fit randomly into the same slot, and you should all play the same way, I think when you play that would be like telling a lot of French chefs that they should all cook the same recipe. I think it would be terrible for the game. And I think that the really good coaches are the ones who are able to look at what are that person's unique individual talents and how can I make the most of them, rather than how can I get everybody to fit into my system. And so to me it just makes sense. It's a fuller utilization of a person's skills. It would be like being in a company and a company not recognizing what your specific skills are and just making you, you know, build a widget just like 1,000 other people could do it. I think that's where motivation and being energized about the sport, I think that's where it comes from when they say, boy, this person is speaking to me individually, speaking to me, not to me as a product, but to me as a person. That's the fun of coaching.
In the philosophy there, have you put your own stamp on your philosophy, or was it built by other tennis people?
Oh, you know, it's very funny. We call it creative swiping in our industry, Jason. We always think that we've sort of come upon these wonderful ways of explaining things, and I think that's the value of learning. When you learn something and you've really internalized it, it really does feel like your own. And one time I listened to my former coach give a lecture on tennis, and he'd written some books, and he was just a wonderful writer. And it just flowed off his tongue so easily. And I realized that after I've been coaching for 5 or 6 years, I knew it so well, I thought it was mine. And so I can't really tell you. I just try to learn from everybody. Everybody's got one little nugget. When we go to our coaches' convention, we'll just sit around at the pool or over a beer at night, and someone will say, well, this is what we did in doubles, and it'll be worth most of the seminars. There's always something that's interesting. And I've always believed that you stop being a great coach when you stop being a great learner. So I hope that right through the end of my career, I hope that I will continue to just sort of be insatiable. I want to know everything about the game. I won't ever be able to do that, but I never want to lose that drive to know everything about it.
Now, the number one reason kids play sports is for fun. So how do you keep it fun, Dave?
We really study it, Jason, because there are some coaches who just know how to keep it fun. They don't try to overlay their own need to succeed on what is really a fun experience. I mean, I think we face a huge challenge in our system between kids who are getting burned out. And I think when kids have a feeling of autonomy and they feel they're getting a chance to chase after something rather than they're trying to live up to some expectation for them. We always tell our players that expectations have negative potential. So if you put pressure on yourself to have to do this, you're going to perform worse. And so a lot of that fun is taken out when you make people chase rankings and make them chase points. And you say, you know, there's a huge pressure. You've got to win the Ivy League title. Well, I think that's nonsense. I don't think the great coaches say this is what we're aiming for. I think the great coaches go out and say, just do your best. Have a ball. This is a privilege. We're lucky to be able to do this. And when you allow the game to remain simple, it remains you can have a childish delight in it. And when as adults we try to over-organize it, we take the fun out of it. And that's why we lose a lot of the kids, because we take an adult approach toward goal setting and, you know, we make it a business and we take the fun out of it. And so we talk to our captains, we listen to them, we say, how are we doing? What can we do better? When do we need to break this up with a game of ultimate frisbee? How could we do it differently? So I think there's a very different kind of organization that's being built these days as we look at industry and things, Jason, is that I think the principle is that all of us together are smarter than any one of us individually. And we're getting kids that are coming from having worked with some of the best coaches in the game. So if we don't listen for that, we're probably missing something. If we think, hey, listen, you're in my program now, let's do it my way. Again, I think we're going to get less out of them than we get if we're open and learning. Truly, we have to have a philosophy. And we've talked a little bit about what that philosophy is. But boy, you have to be open. The game is changing every day. And you got great people doing really good work out there. And I want to hear my players. You know, a lot of things that I do better now have been because my players came back after a summer working with this coach or that coach on a Davis Cup team and said, you know, this is what I learned. I always ask people, what's the best thing you learned in the last few years? And I do that with every coach pretty much I meet. So I guess that's the philosophy, is just to be a learning machine and continue to share that enthusiasm for learning with your players.
Do you have a favorite team building exercise that you participate in?
We do a lot of talks where the players are really being encouraged not to just sort of talk in a, we call it a vanilla way, just without hurting anybody's feelings. We say, look, if you're really going to get down to the heart of the issue. You know, some guy not working in practice, or some guy could do it better, or some guy always comes late. Or, there has to be a kind of edgy quality. If you're going to push for performance at the upper levels, you can't be satisfied with this kind of vanilla, let's all sing Kumbaya together. So I think you have to be willing to confront things as a coach. And I think when the players end up recognizing that you care about them, But all of our behaviors are open to comment. I think if they feel safe and they know that we love them, and we really do love them, then it's a safe enough space for them to grow and feel challenged without feeling diminished. There's nothing worse than shaming a player. And I think we lose a lot of players because adults just come in heavy-handed. And certainly any of the mistakes that I've made in coaching have been when I was younger and I let my ego get in the way. And I think that's dangerous. It takes the fun out of it for kids. I think we have to keep it fun and still have it be responsible. They still owe a responsibility to their teammates to give their best. That's really what it's like in any, if you're going to help a kid grow up, they have to buy into the fact that being on a team is part of their maturing process. And so we look for kids that understand they don't come in and everything's perfect. They come in as they're a work in progress. And if we get that right, if we get the right young men, boy, they're a joy to have, even when we're going through the tough stuff.
Coach, I got to ask, you've been there 39 years. Are you still building a program or have you built a program?
Well, I think there's, you know the phrase, if you're not going forward, you're going backward. So if I were to sit here and say, boy, look at all we've done, we'd be going backwards because someone else would be doing more. And so we're trying to say, look, we all have X amount of hours in a day. We all have families that we have commitments to. We have to do it in a sane fashion because there's no sense in doing it completely out of proportion. But in that time, could we do something a little better? Could we identify recruits a little better? Could we coach the team so that they're able to get just a couple more points because their heads are in the right place when they're doing it? Is there something that we could ask them to read that would sort of give them a little more support in a tough time? Is there a little better job that we could do with our conditioning instead of doing what what the football players are doing is there's something that's a little more state of the art in the way tennis, the marvelous way that tennis is being played at the high level. So we're uncovering, trying to, every stone we can. We're trying to make Harvard a center of excellence. We've been really fortunate to have people like Eric Butorac. Eric is the you know, just a wonderful success story. They should write a, they should make a movie about him. He went to a D3 college, Gustavus Adolphus, and now has had 12 or 13 years on the pro tour. He's become president of the ATP Players Council. He's just a marvelous example of making the best of opportunities. So he's one of the best doubles players in the world. He was a finalist in the Australian Open 2 years ago, and he's been working with our guys, and every day he shares that kind of professional attitude for what it's like to just try to get better at one thing every day. We've had Tim Mayotte, former top 10 in the world on the American Pro from Springfield, who's come in and been a USTA national coach. He's been our volunteer coach. We've had Jez Green, who is Andy Murray's trainer for 7 or 8 years and helped him get to a place where he could win Wimbledon and the Olympics. We want to know what the very best are doing, and then saying if our guys ever had the talent to move that next level, what were the things that they needed to have been doing during those 4 years of college, and then do them. And because we don't want our guys to be held back simply because they also take pride in their academics.
And Coach, change gears here just a little bit. You're involved with the UTR. And me being a tennis fan, I understand what the UTR is, but for some of my listeners out there, could you help explain what it is?
Sure. About 60 years ago, Jason, I was doing some research. I'd been very involved in the development of the collegiate game through the Intercollegiate Tennis Association. And at Chuck Creasy's suggestion, actually, I had been looking into the nature of rating systems. I didn't really fully understand them. Then I began to learn about how good the French system was of rating players. They really only rank about 60 players in the whole country on the men's side, about 30, 40 on the women's side. And that's really just because agents are each trying to, you know, get better deals for their people. So they have to have some rankings. But the rest of the country is really rated according to their levels. And they just have a marvelous system where they produce, their system produces about 12 times more players per capita than our American, what I would call an age-based system, where we put kids together by the 12 and under and 14 under and 16 under. And the statistics that a very interesting man named Dave Howell, who started Universal Tennis, realized that in level-based systems like college or like the pros, when you look at how many more competitive matches happen in that environment, it's stunning. So he created a metric and said, look, how do we judge whether a match is competitive or not? And he said, well, if you look at a match, thousands of matches, and you just said, look, if I could get 7 games or more in the 2 out of 3 set match, maybe I could go 3 and 4 with a player that's much better than me. I've reached a competitive threshold. And so he started examining tournaments at different levels. And he looked at the pros, and it turned out the men reached this competitive threshold 70% of the time in their Grand Slam tournaments. At the college level, our best tournaments also reached competitive threshold 70% of the time. And then he looked at a regular USTA junior tournament and it reached it about 27% of the time. And so in effect, what the light bulb that went off for me was we've created a system now where the kids are getting 3 out of 4 matches that are not really stimulating to the very good players. And they're humiliating to the bad players who are getting drummed. And we're wondering why we're losing 37% of the kids each year from the tournaments who try to play that pathway. So that's when I realized, wow, there's a huge advantage. Imagine if everybody in the country could be rated according to their level and actually play in competitions like they do in college according to their level. So I wrote a white paper and caught the attention of John Vigozin, the then president of the USTA, and he tried to have it implemented. It ran into some sort of bureaucratic, just red tape, didn't get anywhere, but it, it, it almost spread like, you know, if you throw something into a pot of boiling oil, it spills out and splashes all over the place. Well, the idea is splashed out, and people everywhere began to say, hey, why can't we build a system like this? You know, it's more affordable for kids. It's more motivating for them to think about themselves not as ranked 378 in the country, but as a certain level. How do I get better at this level? Essentially, how do we take the advantages of a French system and build it here? And so, so everywhere over the last 6 years, it's spread throughout college tennis. It's a great identifier for seeing, could a kid from Melbourne, how does he compare against this kid from Miami? Eventually, it'll let us keep historical ratings of players' trajectories of improvement. That's going to be sensational for, you know, the U.S. to compare how their players are doing against the development system in Australia or in France. At every level, it begins to give us a tool for players identifying where they really stand, not according to how good they are at chasing points in our age-based system, but really how good they are if they play a player better than them. UTR is fantastic because it rewards you based on how many games you win versus games you lose. And so even in a losing effort, you can still show that you've done your personal best. In some cases, it actually lists your rating if you've done better than expected against a better player. So it's a marvelous system, one I would encourage anybody and everybody to understand better, because to me it can be the new operating system for tennis worldwide. There's no reason it can't. I think that a lot of federations have fallen into a system of points per round rewards for how far you get in each round, but it really doesn't show how you do against specific levels of players, and I think at every level it has advantages for the game. So I've been delighted to see it spreading, and boy, we're having got an article recently in Sports Illustrated. It just seems to be spreading everywhere. We're seeing articles in China, and last week there was one in Ireland. It's being mentioned in England. We've got the LTA, the Lawn Tennis Association in England, submitting results because they see the advantages to their players. We've got Tennis Canada that's created a button for Universal to really upload the results from any junior tournament in the whole country. More and more people are getting on board and saying, wow, this is a global system. It's really fun to know where you stand against anybody in the world. And it really becomes like a universal passport for my player goes over to France. He knows exactly what level of tournament to get into. It's great, and it's just getting better all the time. So I kind of looked at tennis as I got to the latter stages of my career at Harvard. Not that I'm ready to stop, but sometime I will. And I said, what could I do that could influence the affordability and level of tennis more than anything else? And when I looked at this, I saw that, and I've challenged people over the last 6 years to define a bigger single point of leverage that we could put our weight behind that would affect the health of tennis. And now I see it's worldwide, that this would have an enormous effect on the development of tennis and the retention of players, the level of engagement, the affordability of it, the speed of improvement. At every level, it's a winner. And I'm delighted to see an ever-growing community of people behind it. It's really fun, Jason.
Yeah. So what are some of the obstacles you face with the UTR?
Well, I don't think they're really obstacles. I think people are just slow to change. I think that if you look at if you look at New York taxi cabs, you know, they pay $1 million to get a medallion, and then the taxi cab can be rude to you. He doesn't have to keep his car clean. Then along comes Uber, and all of a sudden you've got all these people that were never driving taxis before, they're using their own, you know, SUV to take a passenger somewhere. Well, all of a sudden, the New York taxi cabs are a whole lot better than they ever were. And the cab drivers are nicer. So in effect, competition is really good. And the beauty of UTR is that it allows people to run a level-based event really anywhere in a healthy way. I think it will stimulate a growth in tennis, because you'll take underutilized high school courts, public parks, anything where you have someone that really wants to run a level-based tournament, whether it's sanctioned or not, doesn't matter. It just matters that you can get people of the right level together. And right now, until people are using that and know their level, it's not practical. So in the long run, we hope to build collaborative relationships with the USTA, with Tennis Canada, with Tennis Australia, the LTA, Tennis Europe, ITF. In the end, everybody will benefit from having all the results of the world in one place, because then we'll be able to say, here's the level, here's a tournament in Texas that you can go to 2 weeks from now and have a satisfying experience. I think we're going to keep hundreds of thousands more players in the game down the road. Now, the obstacle is that tennis over the last 30, 40 years has become very fragmented. You've got the pro game, you've got high school game, which is completely disconnected from college. College is pretty disconnected from the pros. Everybody's got their own different ranking system. And when we computed it, we figured there are about 2,700 different ranking systems worldwide.
Oh my.
So at every level, the game has become fragmented. And this is actually something that is using modern tools of big data and algorithms to pull this fragmented system together, to actually reweave a lot of the connections that used to exist. A couple of examples. When I was growing up, I routinely played with adults, and they would drop shot me and move me around the court, and they just knew more than I did. Now we've kind of put juniors, 2 14-year-olds on a court, and we say, go hit cross courts, and then wonder why they don't know how to play on Saturday in a tournament. And if you let those younger players play more often with their older, stronger, smarter peers, they get more savvy faster. And that's what's happening in other countries around the world, where their players are not separated from those older people by the college system. So I think that's the really special part of it. We did a marvelous tournament at Harvard in September where we had 47 people. We put enough prize money into it to attract Marcus Fugate, who was a former ATP player, another player that played Davis Cup for Sri Lanka, who was a local pro. They beat our top two players in the semifinals. Our players beat the D3 players. D3 players often beat the top juniors in our area. We even had a top ITF young lady who played in the tournament, had some great matches. So at every level, I think it's possible to sort of reboot our system and make it more productive. I think not the least of which, I know you share this passion, Jason, but prediction says that we have about 345,000 kids in high school. And right now, probably 90% of them, if you put them in the USTA tournament, they may come away with their tail between their legs. They don't really feel they belong. They're sort of overmatched, and they're often put against kids that are, you know, the top four seeds. And at the end, they come away and say, why did I even try? And so what we hope to do with Universal is to find a way to have all those kids rated so that they actually feel that they're coming into full citizenship in American tennis. That, to me, would be a huge win. Because it used to be, before there was this year-round fast-moving sidewalk that said you have to keep compiling points to get to Kalamazoo, it used to be that some kid that played basketball in the winter would come out and play spring tennis. And by the summer, he was playing a really good level. But that same kid right now can't get into Kalamazoo because he doesn't have enough points. And so we've become more and more specialized, and we've lost a lot of great athletes from the game. And we've taken a lot of the incentive out of trying. So we think that UTR gives those kids a better chance. I think eventually it takes programs all over the country, these wonderful programs like Tenacity in Boston that are helping inner city kids with tennis and tutoring. I think give those kids a rating, and all of a sudden, through local competition, you give those guys a chance to actually become citizens in the American pathway too. So at every level, it's so exciting to see there be a way to energize tennis instead of to talk about losing college programs and losing players, to say, hey, this just wouldn't take better care of the players that we already have. It's going to keep many, many thousands more in the game, because it's really a better system. It's just more appealing, more motivating. So I would encourage everybody to find out about it and see how they can help. We've had wonderful people helping all over the country. And that's why it's spread. USTA NorCal has embraced it. Now USTA Midwest, the second largest section in the U.S., has embraced it. We've got other sections learning about it all the time. We've got college coaches love it. It's a little bit like Facebook, where it's spread first through the college community, because the college community is so international. So, and college coaches obviously were quick to understand, yeah, I can actually identify a kid in Melbourne, Australia, and see how he does against a kid from Minneapolis. So that's kind of no-brainer. And for a young person to look at the level of my team at Harvard versus the level of USC in California, well, all of a sudden now kids actually, they have a citing mechanism for saying, which program could I realistically play in? Now, if I went to this program, I'd be number one right away. If I went to this program, I'd be the water boy. And that's going to help players find the right place now. So at every level, it's a very practical tool. And as college coaches, we track our own players and see how they're improving. It's just fun. We're actually changing our rules in college we may start to consider how some of the UTR tools can be used for our preseason rankings to show how close teams are, instead of having 75 players. You know, it's for some coaches who are ranked 62, when their AD is used to seeing them at 32, they're saying, hey, maybe I got the wrong coach. But what's really happened is college tennis is so close that the number 62 team might beat the number 32 team on a given day, and they might lose a match by a couple of points. And so we'd like to be able to use it to show the level of teams, to show just how competitive college tennis is, and to do the same thing eventually for high school teams. And it's just a marvelous tool. I think that we're just barely scratching the surface of its potential now.
It is an interesting tool, Coach, and I believe that it does have a future in tennis. And I'm so excited that you gotten involved with it and have helped spread the news about the UTR. Before I let you get out of here today, let's talk about your spring just for a second. When do you get started with the dual
match? The kids come back. First time the Ivy League allows us to practice is January 15th, and then we'll play a match on January 16th. It's William and Mary, and actually a doubleheader, so we get our whole team involved. I think we're playing Boston University after that. I don't have the schedule in front of me. So it's a really exciting lineup. We'll head down to Texas Christian for the ITA kickoff event. The following week, we're going to play Oklahoma State in the first round. TCU is playing San Diego State in the other opening round. So that's great tennis for us there. And then we come back and have a terrific February. We have a wonderful tournament called the ECAC Championships, where all eight Ivy League teams will be in. So it's kind of a preview of what April will bring. And then we'll be playing just a number of really fine national teams, Northwestern and Drake, and I don't even remember. It's just a great group. And then our Ivy League season starts in April, and that's sort of 3.5 weekends of great play, and then the NCAA championships, and which we all hope we'll be participating in. We've got a young group, really just fun guys that are kind of chomping at the bit, all seem to be getting better. And it's a privilege to do it, Jason. You know what it's like. You've worked so hard to build a lot of the awareness about tennis, and bringing attention to the really wonderful parts of the game. And you've worked really hard at it. We're all trying to play our role in that.
You bet. Coach, what makes your team so dangerous this spring?
Got a lot of really nice talent, a lot of offense. And so on any given day, you kind of feel like they can knock off a lot of really good teams. And their challenge will be to maintain consistency. We tend to not have guys that are just kind of, run side to side and just do the same old, same old. So we look for guys that have a chance to grow in their game and are kind of keen to see if I got a little bit better at my approach shots and I got in the net and could put someone off balance with a good volley back up the line. Maybe I get the overhead and I get the first drop on the guy. So there's some fun doubles. I'm really looking forward to seeing what we can have for doubles teams this year. And so we hope to stay close to some of the teams that seem a little bit out of our reach. We hope that we'll have good doubles and hope that we can sneak three singles matches from some of the really fine teams.
Well, Coach Fish, this hour has passed very quickly, and I want to thank you for coming on today. It's been a pleasure visiting with you again and finding out what's going on there at Harvard.
Well, Jason, you're kind to invite me. I appreciate it, and thanks for all your good work. And it was a great interview because you let me talk, and I hope I didn't talk too long. But it was nice to share some time with you, and I wish you all the luck.
Thanks, Coach, and look forward to visiting with you again soon.
Terrific. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. David Fish, he's the head men's coach at Harvard University, and his team is currently ranked number 32 in the recent ITA poll, looking for many good things to happen up there out of that Ivy League program. And then also, if you want to, please check out about the UTR, the Universal Tennis Rating. Coach Fish has put a lot of work into this, and it is a wonderful program. And we need to see it expand into the different areas that he's talking about. So thank you for listening in today. We'll bring back next week with another college coach. And have a good week.
Warning. Orthopedic surgeons are seeing an increase in overuse injuries when young athletes perform the same repetitive stressful motions over and over. Pitching, tennis, weight training, even long swimming workouts can cause overuse trauma that may require surgery. If your kids play and train hard, visit orthoinfo.org or stopsportsinjuries.org. A message from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine.